Hello and welcome to the world famous Driving You Crazy podcast. This is the show where we talk about all things transportation, anything that gets you from here to there. I am the traffic anchor and the transportation reporter for Denver 7 News, Jason Looper. And if you would like to be a part of this show, you could always give me a call on the listener hotline. That number, 303-832-0217. By the way, before I get into the whole thing, I call this the world famous Driving You Crazy podcast because I think it is. I was contacted by a couple of stations, one in the UK and the other from Delhi, India, wanting me to talk about the whole airplane FAA NOTAM thing that happened recently, and it was pretty interesting. The UK station, they backed out because after everything was resolved, they decided to move on to a different topic. But I did go on this station in Delhi, and it was pretty interesting. I thought I did pretty well. You could find it here on my Facebook page or my Twitter page. All those links are in the description of this show, and also on my LinkedIn. You can get, I don't know where, you just search Jason Looper Traffic Guy, and I'm sure you'll find my LinkedIn somewhere. But it's all right there. It was actually pretty interesting. But coming up on the show here in just a bit, I'm going to be speaking with Jeff Price. And Jeff is a professor in the Department of Aviation and Aerospace Science over at Metro State University here in Denver. And he's considered one of the world's leading experts in aviation security. He was actually an airport director at Rocky Mountain Metro Airport. And I'm having Jeff on to talk more about the FAA NOTAM system. Now, I have some experience with the system from my time flying in the traffic helicopter because the pilot would have me check mainly for flight restrictions like sports no-fly areas. See, after 9/11, there were these three-mile no-fly zones set up over open-air stadiums. And in Denver, we have two of them, Coors Field, where the Colorado Rockies baseball team plays, and obviously Mile High Stadium, where the football, or you know, the football team, the Broncos, play. And we would have to stay 3 miles out of the area. Now, because I was working for 850 KOA radio at the time, we were a Broncos and Rockies rights holder, broadcast rights holder, and there was an exception to allow broadcast right holder aircraft to get in the TFR. And so then I would have to go through the application process and apply for a special waiver, if you will, so we were allowed to get into the TFR during a Rockies game or a Broncos game so we could fly during those games. And that was right after 9/11, and so we had to deal with that. So that was some of my little experience with the whole NOTAM system. But there's a lot more to it than just that. So I wanted to talk to Jeff and bring him on to talk more about NOTAMs, and we'll hear from him all about that coming up in just a minute because he is very well versed in all of that stuff. But first, speaking of planes and flights and such, there's a friend of mine, David Averin, and he's a motivational speaker. He travels all over the world doing his work, and he's been on more planes than probably most of us will ever see. Now, the other day, he wrote on his LinkedIn page an interesting post about Frontier Airlines, and I want to share it with you. And here's what David has to say. He says, Frontier Airlines doesn't know what business they're in. It was announced that Frontier Airlines would discontinue its customer support helpline, opting instead to only offer digital communication options. No more conversation with a real person over the phone. None. The bean counters at Frontier might be feeling good, but leadership made the inexcusable error of not understanding the actual business they are in. Frontier thinks they are selling seats, when in fact, they are selling outcomes. They are in selling the reunion at the end of the flight, the crucial business meeting that will close an important sale, a long-delayed family vacation, or even a funeral for a recently deceased loved one. When we buy a seat on a flight, we are trusting, betting, that we will make the personal or business connection we desire. Any uncertainty about successfully arriving makes that purchase very risky. Flight scenarios are unique from any other transactions as time, speed, is a crucial factor. Flights leave when they leave. You're on that flight or the next one or you aren't. Frontier believes that a lower price for the seat itself is sufficient to make us look past the risks we would take to book a seat on their airline. Or they assume that millennials who deftly navigate online transactions and conversations are representative of all their flyers. They aren't. In a time when a focus on reducing friction is distinguishing the better companies from the less desirable ones, Frontier is astonishingly adding frustration. Mark my words, the backlash will be severe from this self-inflicted wound. Step back and watch the growing online chorus of furious passengers who couldn't access support during their travels. The vitriol will be deafening. I think they pay lip service to the idea of service. They see themselves as a logistics company moving cattle. When the cattle move, they make money, and when the cattle don't, they lose money. But those cattle have opinions and voices and venues to share their displeasure. They won't really care until they have to. They will teach this experiment in college business classes. Perhaps I will write a book someday titled The Final Frontier. That again, a post on LinkedIn from international traveler, motivational speaker David Averin. And as you can imagine, there were many reactions to his post. This one from Jonathan Hummer. He's general manager at Casemakes. He says, in very few instances, I've ever needed to speak with a real person in customer service at an airline. I have been disappointed, even with the likes of United, American, and Delta. Maybe Frontier is actually ahead of the curve in realizing that most interactions can be handled digitally, especially with an increasingly tech-savvy and socially awkward demographic. And then they don't have to worry about their people taking abuse from angry and frustrated travelers. After all, most of the time, travel occurs without a hitch and you don't really need to talk with someone. And in those rare instances where you do, the system gets overwhelmed easily and you're not really providing a positive service experience. Anyway, I guess time will tell. Now, Callie Benetti, a lead consumer engagement and consumer relations consultant, wrote, "It may not happen immediately, but at some point, those that found the cheapest price to be the most attractive asset of Frontier will voice their opinion that great or even good customer service is expected and an inexpensive price is a bonus. These customers will no longer be repeat customers, no longer will seek membership to the discount den. Everything is good until it's not. The moment a customer is unable to obtain immediate help, especially under stressful circumstances, a once loyal customer becomes the disgruntled customer. My hope is that Frontier decides to roll this out as a pilot." And someone else suggested that Frontier could be purchased by another airline, and making cuts like this and lowering expenses will improve their valuation in the short term before the impacts of the cuts really become apparent to the customers. Frank Kitchen, the Mindset Master Chief, said, "I've worked customer service for years, and too many companies have hidden behind numbers and forgotten how to build relationships, and positive experiences are the key to creating loyalty and stimulating their bottom line." Now, truth be told, I've flown Frontier in the past. It used to be great, but over time, they have drifted more and more towards being like Spirit Airlines. And before this announcement, I tried to call them for certain things, and I never got through. So they're basically just making this no-call center official when it was pretty much unofficial, where you could never get through to them on the phone anyway. And I doubt most callers ever got to a live person before just giving up and going online and dealing with their problems either through email or the chat or at the gate if they were at the airport. And will this affect them in a major way? Probably not, at least not initially, I don't think. Again, more transparency here. I'm going to be on a Frontier flight in March going from Denver to California. Am I excited about that? No. But they offered, even after having to buy my seats and bags, a fare that was $400 less than everyone else for the same flights. So there my family and I will be on a Frontier flight, and I'll report back to you how it went. But like one of the commenters suggested, Frontier not taking calls will eat away at formerly loyal customers, me included. Many, many years ago, I would choose Frontier first, but not now. It was a lot like that. It used to be they would call themselves the Denver's hometown airline. They had great commercials and they had great marketing and really great customer service, but it has been eroded for a long time, ever since Republic took them over and made them a discount airline, much like Spirit. See, I looked for any other option. I was actually nervous about flying Southwest because of their flight issues that they've had. And I don't think they're quite caught up yet. And I looked at United and Delta and American and even other that JSX airline that flies out of a small Rocky Mountain Metro airport up in Northwest Denver. Near Boulder. I looked at them, but that was like a $2,000 or $2,500 flight. I can't pay that. And so I looked at all kinds of flight options, but when Frontier offers a flight leg, one of the flights from, it was either here to there or there back, it was a $15 per person fare. Now, there were taxes and fees on top of that, but still, when it's $15 a person, when the total fare for the one way is $60 for four people, it's hard to turn that down. And then even when you add on the bag fees and buy a couple of seats, it was still way cheaper than any other flight available on any of the other airlines. And it's frustrating. You don't $400 is a lot of money to me. And I want to use that $400 for my trip when I'm out in California, not just to get to California. So will it take more significantly negative experiences for these customers, including me, to say I deserve better and I'm going to look for better even when it costs a bit more? Probably. So this is no more phone issue with Frontier. Probably not going to be a factor early, maybe not be a factor late, but it could help relegate Frontier to an airline of last resort like Spirit. We looked at Spirit, but again, I didn't want to get in the cramped airplane. And they did offer some inexpensive flights, but the flight times were all bad. Here's another thing. So speaking of Spirit and Frontier, this is another change that I saw, that Frontier now only has an allowance of 40 pounds per checked bag. It used to be 50. Most airlines is 50 pounds. That's pretty much the standard. Spirit dropped it to 45. There was one flight that we took. We flew from Denver to Atlanta. We were going to Atlanta to somewhere down in Florida. And we had one bag that was at 47 pounds. We had another bag that was at 30-something, right? And so when I got to Atlanta, we actually left the airport, went out for a while, came back to the airport, and we were checking in again. And when we did that, they weighed the bag, and it was 47 pounds. They said, well, you're going to have to take some stuff out of this one and put it in that one. I said, why can't we just have a total of 90 pounds for the two bags and then call it good? He goes, no, we can't do that. You're going to have to take stuff out of that one and put it in that one. So there I am, basically on the floor of the airport, right at the check-in gate there, not at the airplane, but, you know, in the terminal, taking stuff out of one suitcase and putting it in another. So stupid. I mean, for 2 pounds. And they say, well, it's bad for our employee. No, they can lift the extra 2 pounds, I'm pretty sure, because they were lifting 50-pound bags before, and you could still have a 50-pound bag or heavier on that aircraft. You just have to pay more for it. And the other bag fee, I mean, Frontier's bag fees now are ridiculous. It was 55, and I think it jumped up to 75. You have a third bag; it's like $100 for the bag. That is crazy. Now we because I have more people, I can distribute that cost over a couple of people. But seriously, 40 pounds for a checked bag, is that's the new limit? That is ridiculous. Will I look? Yes, knowing all these things again, I will take it into more consideration. But I guess my limit right now is $400. So I'll let you know how the flight goes and how all that happens and see how it works out after the trip. And you can let me know what you think about any of this. You can always contact me in the description of this show on any of the contact links there. I'd love to hear from you on the listener hotline at 303-832-0217. Speaking of flying, as we know, last week the FAA had what you could say was a catastrophic failure of their NOTAM system. It was previously known as Notices to Airmen. That's how I know it. But now it's called Notices to Air Missions. And I have limited use of the system, as I explained earlier, from my time flying in the radio and television helicopter. But I wanted to learn more about the system overall, what it really is, how it works, why it's important. Plus, why did this happen and can it be fixed in the future. So I've invited Jeffrey Price to be here on the show. Jeff is a professor at the Department of Aviation and Aerospace Science at Metro State University right here in Denver. He's considered one of the world's leading experts in aviation security, was airport operations over at Denver Stapleton International Airport, assistant security director at DIA, and then went on to become the airport director at Rocky Mountain Metro Airport, where we used to fly out of for quite some time. Jeff, thanks for being here. Thanks for being here on the world famous Driving You Crazy podcast.
Absolutely. I'm going to do the same thing. Absolutely. No problem.
All right. Before we get into the NOTAMs and all the other airport stuff that I mentioned, I briefly mentioned some of your aviation background, but you have been around airplanes and airports for a long, long time.
Yes, I actually started out at Metro State back in the 80s. I was a student there in the pilot program. And so I've got a little over 30 years total time in the industry, going a variety of different places, including Denver and Rocky Mountain Metro.
Let's start now with that NOTAM system. Explain, as a pilot, when you're ready to fly, how do you check it? And why do you check that before you get into the cockpit and then head out into the skies?
Typically, what you'll do is just go online to one of the approved websites where you download your weather and flight information, or some pilots will use a tablet and pick up the NOTAM information from their airport of departure, their airport of arrival, their en route flight, and just pick up that information, read that as they prepare for the flight. Meanwhile, they're checking weather and they're checking weight and balance and other things. What the NOTAMs are, really, the Notices to Air Missions, as they're now called, it's really kind of a message board for pilots, air traffic controllers, and airport operators to use to share safety of flight essential information. So it's information that hasn't made it into the flight publications yet, but it's a little bit more real time, but not exactly happening at that second. Anything that would be happening like literally at that second, air traffic control would say, hey, there's a hazard or there's weather or something. But this is all just part of the preparation for the flight. It's kind of like if you're leaving your house in the morning and you're going to check traffic and weather before you drive to work.
Yeah, because you want to know if the roads are closed, and that's what I'm there for. And these NOTAMs apparently are also there to let you know if there's a issue there at the airport that you're going to. A taxiway might be closed, or there might be a flight restriction. Let's say it'd be a hazard if you have a flight from, let's say, Miami to Jacksonville, and there is a space mission about to go, and you might see one of those SpaceX rockets launch. You probably want to know that as a pilot.
Yeah, that could make for a real exciting day. The anything along those lines in terms of like aerial firefighting operations, presidential visits, and so, you know, temporary flight restrictions. So we're talking about airspace. We're talking about even the condition of the runway, whether there's snow on the runway. All of these types of things that relate to the whole flight operation go out over the NOTAM system.
Would that also include flight conditions? So let's say there was a pilot that was flying to Omaha and experienced some turbulence somewhere along the route. They could put that into the NOTAM system, and then somebody could pick it up along the way if they're going to be flying that same route?
Yeah, there's a variety of ways they can push that system or push that information out to the system. Some of the other weather reporting, some of the pilot-to-pilot reporting, and then also use of the NOTAM system as well, particularly if it's an ongoing hazard, something that a little bit of turbulence here and there, air traffic control is just going to put that out. But any sort of major event, that's definitely what the NOTAM system is going to be used for.
My guest is Jeff Price. He's a professor in the Department of Aviation and Aerospace at Metro State Denver. We're talking about the FAA and the NOTAM system and the problem that they had recently. As I understand it, the NOTAM system, at least in this instance, you actually started back in the day before everything went online. They tried to modernize it. I can't say that. We'll talk more about that in a second. But you actually called a phone number, right? And then they moved it online.
Exactly. We'll say back in the day, when I was learning to fly in the 80s, you called the flight service station. That was the FAA office locally, and they would give you the weather information through the various weather reports that go out, and then they would also give you the NOTAM information, and you'd sit there and dutifully write all that information down that was relevant to your flight operation. Then you could file your flight plan through the same office, and off you went.
And now they've moved that system online, and it seems like, you know, government is trying to make it more efficient, but in the process, maybe they've missed some steps along the way.
I think what the challenge has been is the FAA always seems to be a little bit behind the curve when it comes to keeping systems updated, upgraded, and current with the way the rest of the world's working with technology. Some of that's inherent just because you want to make sure that before you make a change to the system, you're talking about critical safety of flight issues. So before you start making changes to the system, you need to make sure that what you're implementing works and is not going to actually be worse or not work at all. But the system with NOTAMs, the challenge has been they started back in the days when we were communicating through telex, and that's why we were using all these abbreviations and using all these acronyms, which pilots now still have to learn. So even though we can put out plain language NOTAMs if we wanted to, they're still using a lot of abbreviations and acronyms that pilots have to learn or go look up if they're not sure what it is. And that can even be before flying. I don't know what this abbreviation means. What's going on at this airport? Then they have to go look that up before they go fly. So I think getting to a system that is kind of like how the rest of the world communicates more in plain language is going to reduce errors, both in NOTAM issuance and in reading NOTAMs, and actually make for a little bit more resilient system.
So do you think there is a better way to notify pilots before they start to fly and while they're already in the air to let them know what is going on at the next airport or at the airport they are currently in? Is there a better way by maybe using the tower or ground control to give that information to the pilots?
Yeah, the whole system it's a symbiotic system. So before I take off, I'm going to check my notices to airmen, or no, same thing here. It's been a while.
I know.
When you say notices to airmen for right. 30 years and they suddenly change it. When you check your notices to air missions, and I'm going to also check with what's known as the automated terminal information service, which is a recording that the pilot or that the air traffic controller will do, gives current winds and weather and conditions at the airport. So I'll check that as well. And that's going to give me additional information that's even more real-time than the NOTAM. So there's really kind of a series of documents and processes you check before you go flying. One's the published information that's been out there for a couple of months. There's documents I can check for that. There's NOTAMs that give me a little bit more real-world. Then there's air traffic control information, which is giving me as close to real-world conditions as possible. The thing with the NOTAMs, I think, rather than transmitting them in a different way, they could be made more simple just in terms of plain language. There's some abbreviations we need to keep in there just to keep things simple, but for the pilot perspective, so they're not reading the same stuff over and over all the time. They just know, okay, that's the temperature, that's the runway we're talking about, or the taxiway. I don't need to type the word runway all the time. I can type RWY. But then there's other things where they have a whole book of abbreviations that they could probably make those simpler. And just rather than trying to use acronyms and abbreviations all the time, just write plain language. Hey, there's people working on and off the runway at this point in time. Use caution. So rather than trying to abbreviate all of that.
My guest is Jeff Price. He's the professor in the Department of Aviation and Aerospace over at Metro State in Denver. We're talking about the NOTAM system and the FAA failure that they had recently. The FAA says that they're modernizing their system, the NOTAM system, but I'm sure that they are moving, I think it was we mentioned, at the speed of government. And on the day of the issue, I couldn't log into the system at all. I could find the graphic TFRs where you could find if there was a presidential restriction or those sort of things, so you can find out where you shouldn't be flying. But I couldn't get into the NOTAM system online. Are they modernizing that to the point where maybe they can handle a lot of people trying to log in all at one time? Like, you might see Ticketmaster that's all trying to sell a concert for what's her bucket? Taylor Swift. Yeah. Where it just crashes. And maybe is it the same kind of issue that the FAA had?
Very possibly could be. It just could be a system capacity issue. It's hard to say because the FAA is not always forthcoming in what the problems actually are. So it could just be your standard IT type system crash where it's too much data at once. Could be any number of factors into there as to why this occurred. I mean, everything from cyber attack to just overload of the system. But the FAA has been trying to update the NOTAM system, and to their credit, they've made good strides in there over the past decade or so. They finally created what's known as a FICON or field condition NOTAM. So now I can look just specifically if I want to know what the condition of the runway and taxiway are, I can look just for those FICON NOTAMs. I don't have to look for every other NOTAM that might not even impact my flight. Or I can check the box on that and say, okay, that doesn't bother me. That doesn't need affect me. Oh, wait, here's the field conditions. Good. Now, this is the information I know I definitely need for this flight. So they have made efforts to simplify things. They just need to keep going with it.
How dangerous would it have been to allow the aircrafts and the pilots to take off to continue the domestic departures during that outage of the NOTAM system and allow them just to start flying to the next place that they needed to get to?
I think, imagine taking off from your, just driving away from your house and having every traffic light not work and having no ability to see where the traffic is or what the weather is, and everybody leaves at the same time and nobody has any clue what's going on in the system. That would just be a recipe for failure on the highway. Now let's take that to the skies, where pilots wouldn't have, I mean, they had had standard weather reports because that wasn't part of that, but they wouldn't know the field conditions at different airports. They wouldn't know which runways were closed at a particular airport. They wouldn't know about that construction crane that popped up overnight that nobody heard about ahead of time. They wouldn't know about any airspace closures. They just navigational aids, which are also essential to flight. They wouldn't know which ones are working, which ones to rely on. It'd be absolute chaos.
So it was definitely then the right call to just ground planes until they could get them going once again.
Exactly right. It's really what the system is. I don't know if it's designed to do, but they did what they needed to do, which was shut things down, do their reboot of the system. I know they're having all airport operators right now go to their own NOTAM sites to make sure that their NOTAMs are still valid, that they're still correct. That's something that's happening during this process, or that has happened during this process, is having all the airports do this. So that's something that really needed to happen just for safety of flight issues, is shut down the system, let's reboot everything, either literally or figuratively, and start building the system back in place. I mean, the last time we saw this kind of an airspace shutdown was 9/11. So this is pretty much without precedent.
Right. And I remember I was flying on that day in the helicopter, flying around it. We were already over at 225 in Parker Road. We were watching the coverage from New York in the helicopter and saw the planes flying into the buildings. And we were almost immediately, we were right there in the Buckley airspace. They told us to immediately leave their airspace, and we traveled west a little bit, and then the DIA tower told us we have to land immediately at the closest airport possible, and we were grounded for several months after that. But it was freaky to be flying on that day at that time.
Oh yeah, yep. I was on the ground when 9/11 happened, and I was grounded for it because I was out of town, so I was grounded for several days along with everybody else. And yeah, I just remember getting on the plane when I was departing, and the pilot, this was probably 6 days after 9/11 when I could finally get a flight, and the pilot saying, okay, folks, we're all in this together. We're going to make sure nothing's going to happen on this plane, and I'm going to expect your help with that. And I'm like, wow, I've never heard an announcement like that on an airplane before. It was just unprecedented times.
Right. Everything just changed dramatically. My guest is Jeff Price, professor in the Department of Aviation and Aerospace at Metro State, talking about the FAA and NOTAM system and other issues at airports. You were the assistant security director at Denver International Airport. You were a security screener for a time before 9/11 happened, and know about security issues and screenings that happened before and after 9/11. Is the current TSA security measures that they're doing now at airports, is it really keeping us safe?
I think it is. And I think that if people did not know what it was like prior to 9/11, then they have no idea what the difference is between what it used to be like versus what it's like now. I was a screener back in the 80s for a period of time. It is a thankless job. it's still a thankless job. Those people have to put up with so much. But prior to 9/11, the FAA had the security role, and we were airline contractors because it was the airline responsibility to do screening, and that the standards were just not that high. I mean, we allowed knives of up to blade lengths of up to 4 inches, and the technology was basically 1970s technology that we're using in the late 80s, and that same technology was in place all the way up until 9/11. We just hadn't upgraded that technology during that time, nor did the pay really increase for the screeners. So after 9/11, they become government employees. The pay finally gets more commensurate with the job duty and responsibility. We upgrade all the technology. We're changing processes still to this day to try and make things more effective in terms of finding objects and finding bad people. So there's a lot more in the system than there ever used to be. That said, are we 100% safe and secure? No, we'll never achieve 100%. Our goal is deterrence. Our goal is to make it difficult enough so that a bad actor picks another line of attack besides aviation. I can't affect anything outside my world. So we want that level of deterrence. So they say, you know, if we try this, we might actually get caught. Let's try something else. Let's go somewhere else.
Whenever I've gone on a flight, there's times you'll see people bring, you know, food or alcohol in the Ziploc bag. And I've done that too. I've had flights out to Las Vegas with some buddies, you know, post 9/11, where you have to put your little, you know, alcohol container in the Ziploc bag. Well, you can cram it. It's I think the limit is 100 milliliters, I think, for each of the bottles. And you can get enough, I think, 5 of those 100 milliliter bottles in a quart size Ziploc bag. And that gives you at least 2/3 of a regular fifth of liquor that you might think of. And they're not checking to see what kind of alcohol you have in there. You could have the Bacardi 181 you could have the Everclear basically and have nearly a 2/3 bottle full of almost pure alcohol that would do damage if you light it on fire on an airplane.
Absolutely. That's one of the challenges of our system is we have to try and be as safe and secure as possible, but the system also has to work. So there's always going to be a compromise in the system. And when we see things like the liquid restrictions, what they're really trying to do in those cases is get the amount of liquids down to a manageable level of what they can look at as it goes through and really provide that level of deterrence. The challenge is anybody that really wants to do something is going to be able to do it. But the thing is, my counter argument to that is, well, if that's the case, then why do we even lock our doors when we leave our house? If somebody really wants to break in, they're going to break in. We should just leave the front door open. Well, no, we don't want to do that because it makes it way too easy. Let's lock the door. Maybe they'll go somebody else's house. So that's what we're trying to do is provide enough levels of security so that they try and go somewhere else, or the chance of getting caught is higher than the risk. And that's really kind of the dichotomy in our system, I guess, is the best way to put that.
My guest is Jeff Price. He's a professor in the Department of Aviation and Aerospace at Metro State Denver, and we're talking now about some airport security issues. I have a TSA PreCheck. I actually got it for the whole family because it's a lot easier to get through. We don't have to take the laptops out of the bags. We can keep our shoes on, all those kind of things, all for just providing the TSA or the federal government with my ID and my picture and that sort of thing. So what's to stop somebody from doing all of that and still being a bad actor? And can't the TSA, obviously they can screen my laptop from inside my backpack. So why can't they just do that for everybody?
It's really a matter of trust. And what's going to be the test of the pre-check system is the first time somebody commits some sort of criminal or terrorist act that was on the pre-check list. That will be the acid test to see if this is really something that we want to continue to rely on. The theory behind PreCheck, and I'm a PreCheck member too, like you, my whole family has PreCheck. If we didn't, we'd have missed our flight out of Orlando last summer for the cruise. So I made sure I'm like making everyone, you're all getting pre-checked. The challenge is going to be if somebody actually gets through with something and commits some sort of criminal or terrorist act. The theory is when you do your pre-check, you get fingerprinted. We know more about you than we know the average passenger. So we're going to give you a little bit more trust because we know more about you than we do about the average passenger. And then we're also going to throw some random elements in the system with the occasionally bringing the dog over to the pre-check lines, occasionally pulling people out of pre-check, occasionally pulling people out for random screening. So that's almost kind of let's make sure the honest stay honest here. But it's also to, you know, to a terrorist or a criminal, they know that there's the possibility that that could occur to them. So that's kind of that layer of protection.
But Jeff, those dogs can't smell a knife. They can't smell what kind of alcohol and how much I have in my Ziploc bag. They can't smell everything. They can smell explosives or drugs, but they can't smell everything.
No, they're going to smell the explosives. Depending on the kind of dog they are, they might be able to smell the drugs. Some of them can smell other elements. We see that through customs checkpoints and so forth. But it really, comes down to it. The dirty little secret in the industry is, yeah, there are ways of circumventing the industry, but it's better than just kind of leaving the front door open is really what it comes down to.
And I've heard of there's technology to determine, it's almost like a facial recognition technology, but it's almost a technology that will see if there's a higher level of blood pressure or somebody's acting a certain way. Aren't there cameras or ways to find if somebody is acting strangely in the airport and that might be a tip off to that something's not right?
There is that technology out there and it's been tested. I don't think it's used in any U.S. airports on a consistent basis. Internationally, it's been tested. It's really kind of a artificial intelligence version of the profiling is what it comes down to. So, and by profiling, I don't mean racial profiling or nationality or anything like that. I mean, taking a look at somebody and looking for the signs of nervousness and so forth, just to see if we should talk to them a little bit more. And it's just basically using that as technology instead to try and identify those types of individuals, really.
As I've been mentioning, that you are a professor there in the Department of Aviation and Aerospace in Metro State. And you, if I looked it up, you have actually a 4.6 rating. So congratulations on that.
Awesome.
now there's no doubt that there's a shortage of pilots out there, but you got to think that the cost of flight time and college courses has to be pushing some of the good candidates away.
They are. They absolutely are. When I ran the numbers between how much it cost me to get my flight ratings back in the 80s, and you factor in the inflation rates, there's no comparison to how much they're charging today for flying and just how expensive it is to earn a pilot certificate. I mean, I paid like 15 grand to get all the way through my commercial certificate. Today, a student will pay 70, 80 grand or more sometimes for that. Whereas if you run it the inflation calculator on something like that, it's not even that much at all. So the cost of flight training by leaps and bounds has increased, and there's a lot of people that would love to do it. And I see it in the flight schools where they start flying and they just go, I just can't afford to do this anymore. Then they have to go off and do something else.
Could they ever earn that money back if they get to a certain point? Or, I mean, it must take years and years. I flew in the helicopter for many years and earned all those flight times, but we were flying about 1,000 hours a year. So that was a lot of flying for me, even though I grabbed the stick a couple of times. I guess I should have used that time more wisely. But will a student ever earn that back? It seems like it would take forever.
They do eventually. When you run the numbers on this, they'll eventually get to that point where they're going to be making a pretty good living, whether that's with the airlines or the private aircraft or charter aircraft industry. The game is stick with it long enough and you'll eventually get the reward. It's just the cost of entry is so high that that deters a lot of people from it. But if they get there, then the reward eventually will come.
And it is, as the work for, as a pilot, if you're working for, let's say, Spirit or JetBlue or Frontier, is it that much different than working for the big guys like Delta or United or American?
Pay rates are variable from airline to airline, but the overall, it's still going to be a wash somewhere down the road in the end, just depending on how long you're there, the type of aircraft you're flying, and the type of flying you're doing, whether, you know, like I said, private charter or cargo or the low-cost carriers or kind of the legacy carriers. So there's all going to be differences there, but anybody that sticks it out is eventually going to get there.
And you know, that was actually an interesting point. You brought up cargo, and it just triggered my mind. When I was watching, I was tracking all the flights on the day of the FAA issue, the NOTAM issue, and I was seeing a lot of planes from DHL or FedEx or all the delivery services basically that were still flying and still going to these places because they're not carrying passengers, they're carrying your packages.
Exactly, and that's part of the safety issues too. Is what are we talking about in terms of how many people are on board this aircraft and what airports are they going into, and can we convey that information through other means for a period of time? Because I think the FAA switched to just using old school radio transmissions to talk about safety of flight information during the early morning hours. But as flight operations on the passenger side start kicking up, then they couldn't continue to do that. They had to shut the system down.
Yeah. What do you teach your students about how aviation is going to look in 5 years, in 10 years? What are some of the biggest changes that they will see? Like maybe instead of two pilots, one pilot, or changes with the aircraft?
The thing that I always teach my students, and I've been between being part-time and full-time instructor, I've been at Metro since 1995, full-time since 2003. And the thing I've always taught my students is our industry is cyclical. So when the pandemic happened in 2020, prior to that, we couldn't provide enough pilots to the air carriers. Suddenly the air carriers are furloughing pilots left and right because of the pandemic. And I'm talking to classes full of students who think that I better change careers because I'm not going to have a job because of the pandemic, and look at things like Zoom, and you know, that's all that stuff's going to take over, and I'm not going to have a job in 6 months or 6 years. And just my advice to them was wait, just keep plugging away, wait it out. It's going to change. We saw this after 9/11. They furloughed tens of thousands. We saw this after the recession of 2008-2009, furloughed tens of thousands. But that wasn't happening across the industry. So whereas just like with the pandemic, we saw air carrier operations go down, but then we actually saw charter and private flight operations go up. So the industry's cyclical, and even though you might have one part of the industry that's furloughing people and not hiring, other parts of the industry are still doing so. So really the message is, whether you're 5 years out or 10 years out, is stick with it. You just learn to ride the wave. And be prepared to have a backup plan in the meantime if you do get furloughed, because that's a reality of our industry. As far as single pilot operations for air carriers, I know that's been bounced around a lot more recently in sort of the internet sphere, where you've got some air carriers going, hey, this might be a way for us to save money from a passenger perspective, from a pilot perspective. I still want at least two people up there in the flight deck. What happens if that one pilot has a medical issue? What happens if like the landing in the Hudson, you needed two brains operating up there to get that plane safely down out of the sky after the bird strike? One person, it would have been saturation, just information overload. So for all the hours that pilots might spend just plowing through clouds, they're getting paid for that time when there's an emergency and they need to think on their feet and work together.
What you need, though, if you just had one pilot and he goes down for a medical issue, you got to call Ted Stryker from Coach. like in the movie Airplane, to come rescue you.
That's right.
And save the day.
But he'll never be over Macho Grande. So
no, he will not. No, he will not. Well, Jeff, thanks. I appreciate all your insight, your expertise. Jeff Price, the professor in the Department of Aviation and Aerospace at Metro State Denver. Thanks again for all of your expertise in all of these issues. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Jason. Take care.
Thanks again, Jeff. If I could do it all over again, go back in time, go back to being a teenager, I think I might want to go learn to be a pilot and fly private planes. I think that would be kind of fun. Pretty cool. My first love is broadcasting. That's why I'm here doing this. I guess maybe I could have combined the two, learned to be a pilot and then done a future. But, you know, podcasting wasn't a thing when I was a kid. And the YouTube thing wasn't a thing when I was a kid and all this stuff. So I guess I could have combined it like I have later in life, combined flying and broadcasting. Because I guess to a small extent, I'm doing that right now as I cover transportation and do this show as well as other things. So I think I could go back and be a pilot. I think I still might want to get a pilot's license, but I'm telling you, that flight time, it's something else, and it's really expensive. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always contact me on the links in the description of the show. So thanks again for being here. Thanks for listening. And until next time, I'm Jason Luber, the traffic guy. Be safe, and as always, happy motoring.